Okay, so welcome back. I want to spend a few minutes before I start talking about the third assignment. I am hoping that most of you have actually started on it, but just to clarify any question, let me just review it briefly, and if you have particular questions, this probably is a good time to ask. Okay, so the basic goal of the assignment is to use replication for two purposes. We have said replication can be used for scaling the performance of the system, and it can also be used for high availability. So we will use replication for both of these purposes in this assignment. So you again have your two-tier Whisper application, and both of the tiers are going to be replicated in this assignment. The first tier, or the front tier, is replicated for performance, and the back end tier will be replicated for availability. Okay, so the basic picture that you should keep in mind is you have two replicas. Okay, for the front tier. Okay, so for initially assume that, there is only one logical entity for the back end tier, although that's also replicated. So there will be a dispatcher. Okay, client request will be sent to the dispatcher. The dispatcher will have to pick one of the front end replica. So the requests are either sent this way or this way. Either replica can service these requests. Okay. So all of the requests that you had, you can be sent it to either of those two. And then they have to service them by talking to the back end tier. Okay. The additional thing that we will do here is that each of the replicas will have a cache of all the data that they have retrieved from the back end. Okay, so whenever a request comes in, you can look at the cache to see whether you have all of the data. You might have to additionally talk to the database or the backend tier to ensure that you have all of the data that the backend tier has received. I'll talk about that in just one moment. But your goal is, if data is cached, then you don't have to retrieve it again from the database. Okay? It is possible that only a subset of the data is cached, but not all. In which case, you can only retrieve that subset that is required from the database, and the rest you can serve from the cache. Okay. So this is basically the first part, very briefly. Okay. The one additional functionality you have to add here, okay, is basically to ensure that cache is consistent, because you are caching data, and the database itself will keep changing depending on new posts that are going to arrive. We also add the functionality to delete some posts. Okay? Because of this, whatever is in the cache may be either out of date or invalid. Okay? So you have to implement a cache consistency protocol to ensure that whenever a request comes in, you don't respond with data that is either invalid, meaning it's no longer in the database, or you only return a subset of the post, whereas there are more in the database that you have not seen. Okay, so consistency of the cache, which was the topic for lectures, I guess, that dealt with chapter 7. Okay, some of those ideas get implemented here. Okay, so you need to ensure that these caches are consistent with what is in the database. Okay, that's the main purpose of sort of this caching. So there is an additional message that we will introduce here, which is a poll message. Okay, and the consistency protocol that you have to implement is a server push protocol. Okay, we have talked about client pull, server push. We'll review some of that again today in the context of web caching. But this is going to be a server push protocol. So every time data here changes, the server sends messages back to the two replicas telling them about it. Okay, so if there is a post message that has come in here, so since messages can be sent to one of the two replicas, let's say a request came in, went through this replica and it was a post, and the database got updated. Okay, at this point, the server push protocol, I will actually have to do a notify to this cache saying, I have some more data that you may not have seen. Okay. This tells the cache that the contents here are more recent than the contents here, possibly. Because when if new requests come in, it can actually go, it can go and do this poll message to figure out what is not available in the cache and retrieve those, that subset. Okay? Yes, question.
Could you notify just the entry that was updated, so it knows only about the that entry of the cache?
This is a notify message. This is not an invalid rate message. Okay? So notify message just says that there is more entries, no more posts here than here. So assume that there is a topic. There are three posts here, okay, in the database. And let's assume that all three are cached here because some client requested it. Suppose that a post message comes here. It goes to the database and a fourth entry is added here. Okay? This cache, this replica will know that there is a post message. But this replica, since the message went on this path, this replica does not know. Okay, so the purpose of this notify message is to tell the cacher that there are more entries here that have appeared. Okay, so then this replica knows that something has changed. Okay, that doesn't mean that these three posts are invalid. Okay, it just means that there's more data here than here. Yes, question.
Why do we need the poll functionality and notify? It seems like if you haven't been notified, you know that your cache is up to date.
Yes, so just one second. So the poll just allows you to selectively retrieve whatever data is in there. It may be the case that not everything has been cached. Okay? Some subset of the data, you can make these caches as small or as large as you want. Okay? If you assume an infinite cache, there is no problem. But if you assume that this is a cache which can only hold 20 elements, 20 posts, okay? So then that basically tells you that there has to be a cache replacement. Okay, you don't have to implement this. I'm just trying to answer your question. So this is a limited size cache. That means that only some of the subset of what is in there can be cached. So that requires some additional interaction between the cache and the database to figure out what entries are cached and what are not. Notify just tells you that something has changed. That doesn't mean that everything else is necessarily cached. It may not be if you do some cache management. Okay? So notify is one. So the other message you have to, functionality is invalidate. That you have to implement. Invalidate basically tells you that some of the cached entries are stale and have to be removed from the cache. That's what the purpose of the invalidate is. And the reason you have invalidate in the system is we actually assignment added the functionality of deleting posts, which we hadn't done so far. Okay? So we said there's a moderator process that will go and randomly delete some posts from every topic. Okay? So suppose that post, this second entry here has been deleted by this moderator process, which is a separate process that is just going to interact with the database, then it's the job of this server push protocol to let the caches know that if they are caching this entry, it has to be removed from the cache because it's no longer in the database. Okay? So there will be additions to the database and there will be deletions. Additions should trigger notify messages, deletions should trigger invalidate messages. Okay, yes, question.
Is the notify message actually it just tells it.
Okay, that's a good point. So there are two types of notify messages. There are something called an update version of notify, and then there's just a simple notify. If you actually send the post with the notify, okay, then that's called an update. Because you're actually sending the data itself. If you don't do that, you just say that there's an entry number 5 got added to this or some such thing, or an entry was added at this time t. All that is telling the cache is this, an entry got added at this point, or this is the new entry, but it doesn't actually send the data itself. Okay? This I'll leave as a design decision as to what you do. Okay? As specified, this the notify does not require you to send the data itself. It just allows you to tell the cache that the data has changed, and subsequently the cache can retrieve the data if the request comes. Okay. If this data is large, okay, typically sending it over may be wasteful if no requests come here to retrieve it subsequently. Okay. So this is often left as a design parameter. We will again look at this in the context of the web, okay, whether notify should actually just send the data itself or just a message. But you can make your decision. I mean, as specified, it doesn't require you to send data. If you decide, that's fine. Okay, yes, there are more questions here.
If you're sending a poll because you think that you might be missing stuff in your cache, every time there is a retrieve request, then why need to be notified anyways? Anything that will notify you, you're going to get when you call the poll eventually.
Okay, so why do you need to poll? So the reason I added this poll message is it allows the cache to be intelligent. Okay, suppose that several notify requests have come here. Okay, but they are not actually sending you data, they are just telling you that data has changed. Okay. So subsequently, you can actually poll for any arbitrary range because it says poll T1, T2. Right? So you can say poll for all messages from 11 a.m. to noon. Okay? And you specify a topic. If this returns in, there are 5 messages. And you also have the same 5 messages, you know that nothing in this range needs to be retrieved. Okay? So poll just allows you to figure out what is missing in your cache and do selective retrieval. Okay? You don't have to use it that way. As you rightly pointed out, poll could be just simply used as a client pull mechanism. What you are saying is you don't need server push, you don't need notify and invalidate. When a request comes, you could simply poll and see if you have all of the messages and retrieve. It is certainly possible to use the poll that way. What I had intended here was, if you receive a notify message, the next time around you could just do a full retrieve and get everything from that topic, which may be more wasteful than is necessary if you have some of those entries cached. So by actually checking ranges, so you can basically take a range of an hour or 100 posts, saying do you have all messages from this point to this point and this, so you can only retrieve the parts that are missing. Okay? That was the intention of the poll message, but you could use it in other ways as you're pointing out. There were 2 more questions, one there, one here.
Yep. So the poll just returns a number? Is the number of messages?
The poll just returns a number. It could return a number or it could return a list of unique IDs.
It could either return either one.
Yeah, could return the unique IDs to say, here are the posts that were actually sent, or you could just return a number. That's again a design decision, how you want to use poll in your system. There's a question there. You have follow-up just on that. Yeah.
Is it possible that with invalidated WISPs and added posts that you could get the same number but actually
yes,
wrong?
That it's absolutely possible. This is why you need to be careful. You could delete one post and then another post could get added. So if you just get a number, so if you had 5 posts, one got deleted and one got added, you're still at 5. Okay. So you might actually mistakenly think that you have all of the data but you don't. In that case, it's better to send a list of unique IDs. Each post has a unique ID so you can compare. Okay? So you have to be careful in how you use poll and not get misled by how it is used. Yes.
So when replica 1 receives that post, is it supposed to cache it immediately?
If replica 1 receives the post, is it supposed to cache? Again, this is a design decision whether you immediately update your cache or not. Okay? It can certainly do that. That's certainly a possibility. Okay? You don't have to, but if you do it, then it saves you some additional work in the future. Yeah.
So just to make sure, caches of unbounded size were okay?
Caches of unbounded size are okay at this point. Yeah, because I didn't say you have to do any cache replacement. If you have bounded size, then you have to add a cache replacement policy, like LRU or something like that. Yes.
To actually go back to the first part of the project discussion, what we did in the first time, it said like you have to do periodic retrieval of code. And for this, like a simple timestamp that not necessarily was wall clock time, something that was a unique integer could do. So if you're like periodically retrieving posts like from T1 to T2 and they're being updated, wouldn't it just suffice if you put that set of posts into your cache on which content server every time you make a post? Or rather, every time you retrieve. So let's suppose your cache on the front end server is a size, let's say 5.
Okay.
And if it's a queue, so every time there's a new post made, it will just keep updating the queue, pushing it out, because a periodic retrieval is being made.
Independent of client requests.
Yeah, exactly.
So here you don't have to do that. You will basically, since you're doing explicit cache management, and there is explicit messaging between the front end and the back end, you shouldn't just go and retrieve just to put things in the cache. That would be called prefetching in the caching context.
Not exactly from the cache, but the first part of the project specified that you have to do periodic retrieval from the client.
Oh, from the client, yeah. That was just the client is reading the data, but the cache is not at the client, it's at...
It's here,
so what's the question? I'm not following.
No, every time a periodic retrieval comes from the client.
From the client, yes. So user, let's call it user, okay.
So it actually what it was supposed to do was retrieve from the first time the server starts up from 0 to n.
Yes.
Then the next period of retrieval would be from n to the next value.
And the user is going to specify that. Yes. That's a user request.
Yeah.
Right. So user says, give me all posts from T1 to T2. And later on, the user may say T2 to T3.
T2 to T3, exactly.
Yes.
So now, if your caches on your content server are automatically updated, and I mean, like, with if you say you post something new to the server, so
yes,
with your notify message, if you send back the last set of posts, like, let's say T2 to T3, the set of posts, and update your cache at the content server.
Okay.
Automatically, is that okay?
That is what you are supposed to do.
No.
I didn't understand what the question is. So if you got a request for T2 to T3 that comes here, the replica checks whether all the posts that were made during this period are in the cache or not. If they are not in the cache, if all of the posts or some subset are missing, you fetch them from the backend here and you put them in the cache. If they are already in the cache, you verify this first. They are already in the cache, no additional retrievals are needed. You just send back the response from the cache.
So a periodic retrieval from the user would be for a set of posts between T1 and T2.
Right.
So in that case, you would have to like either return a set of posts from your frontend server itself,
yes,
or go to the backend server and retrieve that set of posts.
Correct.
Now suppose you had a retrieval for a single post.
Yes.
So
from a user.
From the user.
Okay.
So in that case, would your retrieval from the backend server still be a set of posts, or would you query only for that one post and then update?
That's completely a design decision, right? I mean, if you're asking for one post, should the server do more work and prefetch more data or not, it's up to you. I mean, there's no reason to do more work than is necessary. But if you are doing this expecting that for future requests from other users, because this is not a single user, there are lots of users here, that caching that content helps service future requests because it's now cached here, that would be fine. I don't think that is violates any of the requirements if you do some prefetching, for instance. Not required, but if you do it, it's fine.
Okay. The other thing is about the poll. So it says that you are explaining that timestamp, in the interval T1 to T2.
Yeah.
So is it, I mean, because we implemented it without an exact 1 o'clock timestamp, so is that okay? Basically, you are doing that.
You could do that. Although in the second assignment, we did actually use clock,
but
right?
That was the offset difference between the leader and whatever the time sync that happened.
Right.
That goes into it. But that exactly is still not the wall clock time that goes on to the post.
Yeah. You are using some other. Yeah, that's fine. Are there other questions on this before I move on to the second part? Yeah.
Just to make sure, the only kind of retrieve that the user can do is from some specified time to the present?
From some specified time, yes.
Okay. So is it possible, let's see, that replica 2 get the retrieve and so then it would pull against its current time? Right, from the time the user specifies to the current time, that's what it from its current time, that's what it would call for.
To the database?
Database when it called the poll.
You could do that.
Which I guess is problematic if there are other posts coming in through replica 1 at the same time.
Yeah, so I have not said anything about concurrency at this point, right? So if the posts are actually getting, assume that there is some ordering of requests. If the retrieve came before the post, then just worry about the retrieve, not any additional stuff. Yeah, because we didn't say you have to lock the thing before doing posts or anything like that here. Okay? You did do that for the second assignment. You could just use that or you could simplify. So you will have concurrent users. There are two replicas which are sending requests to the database. Right? So there will be concurrent retrieves and posts in the system. I'm just saying you can simplify it. You can use what you did for assignment 2 or use some simplification. That would be fine. Okay? So the second part of the project, this is just the first part. The second part is that you're going to use replication in the backend as well. But this is going to be used for availability. So the database, there are two replicas. the dispatcher. So all of these requests are now going through. Is there a dispatcher? I'm not sure. There's just a master. No, there's. Let's say something about a dispatcher. Yeah, there is a dispatcher, but it's a trivial dispatcher. All it does is it keeps track of who is the current master. So here you have master and a slave. So the dispatcher just looks at who is the master and sends all the requests to the master. Okay. And then the master is supposed to basically synchronize with the server. Every time there is a post or delete, you just synchronize with the server. Okay. And then the basic the thing you do is if the master goes down, the slave has to detect it and declare itself the new master, so all future requests are sent to it. Okay. So this is the first part, to ensure that crash of a master does not allow the system to stop functioning. Okay. Yes, there's a question.
Can we place dispatch functionality in the front end? So the front end knows which one's master.
Yeah, no, that you can. It's not a problem. You could put the dispatcher here, which is done in web server. Like Apache has our dispatcher that is sitting in the web server. Could that be a separate process? It could be a thread here. Doesn't matter. Okay, but if you put, there will be two dispatchers, one here and one here. So that is the only thing you need to keep in mind, rather than just one. And so both have to know which is the current master. Okay. The one additional requirement is after the master crashes and then it comes back up, its database state will be out of date because the slave which has become the new master actually has gotten more posts in the meantime. So you have to run a synchronization protocol between the master and the slave, which we call the recovery protocol, so that the master can get all of the data it missed while it was down. Once it has synchronized, then it can become the master again, and then the slave which had become the master becomes the slave again. Okay, so you have to do all of this. Yes.
These are the databases, or what happens to the database tier?
What happens? This is the database tier. Yes, absolutely. So this is not a process. There's a process as well as the data. Everything is getting replicated. Right, so whenever, so this has its own files and this has its own files. So everything that's going in the master, you have to send to the slave and keep it synchronized. This goes down and this takes over and it starts serving requests from here. Okay, you will have to keep some additional data structures to ensure, do the resynchronization. Okay, either you can do a poll or figure out how the slave will get all of the data from the master, failed master will get all of the data it missed. You can do a poll on each table and just retrieve those contents selectively, for instance.
Including health has to know what the leak request that happened since,
yes,
it went down.
Yes. So which is why I was saying that it's basically taking each of these ranges and then polling, saying what happened in this period, and then resynchronizing may be the right thing. Okay?
On the eventuality of suppose the master goes down or when the master comes up from the inside.
You could do all of the data, but clearly the reason I am saying resync is that is typically wasteful. Here your amount of data is very little, right? So that would be simpler. But typically if you had a real database, if you had a 1 gig database and 10 megabytes got added, you are not going to copy all of that. So the real databases will run this resync protocol. Okay? So you could do what is done in a database, which is keep a separate log file which tracks all the things that were added. So you can record when the master went down, and then you have a list of all unique IDs of their posts that were made afterwards, all the deletes and adds. You would use that for resynchronization. That's what a database would do. But that's, again, all of that is a design decision. It's not specified here. You could decide how to do. Just don't copy all the data. That's the only thing I would suggest, because that is not the most efficient way to do recovery. Maybe easy, but that's not efficient. Yes.
So once the master comes up, and it resynchronizes for the slave.
Yep.
Why is it necessary to make it the master again? Why can't we have the slave serving as the master?
Yeah, so you can may do that. It's not a problem. You don't have to switch it, but at least it needs to resynchronize. It needs to catch up. That's all. Good. Any other questions on this? Okay. So if there are other questions, just come to me or talk to Vimal. Okay, but I'm assuming that the basic concept is clear. Yeah, do get started on this soon. Don't wait until the last minute again. It's due on, I think, 10th. Yeah, December 10th. Okay. All right. So with that, let's move on to the lecture. Okay, so some of these ideas we will see are actually taken from what happens in the web, okay, in the context of web caching. So today we'll look at web as a case study. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about web clients, web servers. We have looked at some of these ideas in the past when we did threads and processes and so on. But I'll look at that, reiterate some of that material again, and then we'll spend a substantial amount of the class, or what's left of it, doing a study on web caching. In that context, we'll see some of these ideas appearing again. Okay. So very quickly, this is just a picture that illustrates how typical web server works. So there is a client server architecture. It's a client machine that's running a web browser. There's a server machine that's running a web server. This is a simple HTTP server. This could be more complicated if you have a multi-tier application. But in the simplest case, it's just a vanilla HTTP server that's serving static web content, HTML pages, images, and so on. So this is a process. There's a file system that stores the content. Okay? So you send a HTTP request asking for some file or image. The web server processes the request, gets the data from the file system, constructs an HTTP response, sends it back to the browser. Okay? Browser renders it. There are embedded links, then it will start fetching each of those in turn, until it gets everything and it renders a web page. Okay. Very simple so client server architecture. Typically, this is just some additional information on HTTP. So the way HTTP works is it uses the notion of MIME encoding, okay, which allows the response to tell the web, the response that comes back from the server can tell the web browser what type of object it has just retrieved. Here, is it a HTML file, is it a GIF image, is it an audio file, a video file. So in addition to the file that was requested, okay, there are some headers that are added to HTTP responses which tell the web browser, okay, what is the type of the file. Okay. The way this is done is it uses what is called MIME encoding. Okay. This is the same thing that mail clients use when you send attachments. Okay. You add an attachment and send it off. There's a file that gets added to your mail message, but there's additional header information which tells the other end what type of file is it. Is it a PDF document or is it a Word document or whatever you're sending. Okay. So there are various kinds of MIME types, and here are some simple ones that HTTP supports us. Everything from plain text to HTML, which is the most common. You can send XML back. The various types of images, audio, video content, the uninterpreted byte stream, it doesn't tell the browser anything, saying this is a collection of bytes. Okay, things like that. Okay, this is just showing a very simple multi-tier architecture. What we have seen in the project is a little more than this. So here what has happened is you have the server part of the client server architecture is split into multiple components. There's a HTTP server. This is doing just plain HTTP processing, just the protocol processing. Okay. There's a database backend, which is where a lot of the data itself lives. And there's a middle component. Here it's implemented as CGI bin processes. Okay. It could be implemented as J2EE or Java app servers, or it could be implemented as Python or Perl application, but in the simplest case could just have a PHP or CGI script that is acting as the middle tier. Okay, so your front end protocol processing, this is where request handling is actually happening. Okay, the code is written, and that's the database that stores the content. It's a standard three tier architecture. Okay, in this case it's showing how CGI works. Okay, in this is a separate process. It doesn't, this separation does not tell you on which machines each of those components are kept. Okay. It is quite possible that all three components reside on the same machine. Okay, which is if you have a simple website, that is frequently done. Okay. It is also possible for scalability reasons to separate these out. Okay, the database could be its own machine, the HTTP server could be its own machine, the middle application tier could be its own machine. Each of this can additionally be replicated, as we will see in just a moment. Okay. So the one additional detail to keep in mind is many of these web applications now, in addition to supporting HTTP, also support other kinds of protocols. And one important one is actually called SOAP, which allows you to turn a web application into what is called a web service. Okay. When you make a when you write a web service, what happens is this application allows other applications to talk to it, okay, using RPCs. Okay, the RPC protocol that is used in the web is called SOAP, okay, Simple Object Access Protocol. Okay, SOAP. The language that is used to write SOAP applications is called WSDL. Okay, this is the service description language. This is somewhat equivalent to the IDL that you use, the interface definition language that you use in RPC system. In the context of web services, you use this WSDL, okay, web service description language, to write your web or SOAP functions. And SOAP is actually the protocol that is allows you to make a RPC request. Okay, so we'll see the same stubs at the server and the client end. Okay, so instead of sending a HTTP protocol, HTTP request, you send a SOAP request, which is an encapsulation of an HTTP request as an RPC request. Okay, so this is RPC over HTTP that you use. And there are several applications that are written in this fashion. Typically, in this case, the client is not a browser. Okay. The client is a browser, then it's an actual human accessing web content. But in many cases, this could be another application that's talking to a server application, and the two talk using SOAP, okay, which is RPC over HTTP. Okay, so just to give an example of this, so this could be, let's say, a retail application, and this could be a transaction processing system for processing credit card transactions. Okay, so user may submit a buy request to the application and submit a credit card number. Then that application has to validate the credit card. So that application can talk to, let's say, a payment processor site using SOAP request. Make an RPC call saying, here is a credit card, validate it or authorize it. Then you get back a response. Okay, so there are many systems that are written in this fashion. So here is a typical web browser. So we looked at this, I guess, very early on. So this is the client side of the web. Typically, this is the architecture of a web browser. There are multiple components. Okay, there's a user interface, which is the GUI of the web browser. Okay, this is the browsing engine. Okay, this is the part that's actually talking to the server, interpreting HTML, making connections to servers and retrieving content and so on. And then there is a rendering engine. Okay. Rendering engine is responsible for taking content and rendering it on the screen, okay, layout of the image and that kind of stuff. And there are multiple parsers in typical browsers. There's a HTML parser, there could be XML parsers or other types of parsers, depending on what your browser supports. Most browsers, although it's not shown here, most browsers will also have a plug-in architecture, okay, that allow you to extend the functionality of the browser. So if you have something like Firefox, you get these things called add-ons. Okay, those are just plugins that allow you to add functionality. So that's something that most browsers will support today. Okay. So what this is actually showing is a client proxy server architecture. Okay, so the first slide I showed the standard client server architecture, but lot of web sites actually employ proxies, and some of that may be transparent to browsers. Browsers may not even know that the requests are being intercepted and handled by proxies. And we'll look at proxies in the context of web caching. So what happens in a client proxy server architecture is the request is actually sent to a proxy server rather than the original server. And the proxy will typically have a cache. Okay? And if the requested content is in the cache, then it's immediately sent back to the browser. If not, you will fetch it from the server. Okay? This shows a proxy for an FTP server. Okay? The same principle holds for proxy for the web. This is just an HTTP server. And just all these FTP rings are replaced by HTTP. Okay, so we'll look at this in more detail today. But here is, before I move on to web caching, just quick slide on Apache. Okay, so we talked about Apache being a multi-threaded architecture. Okay, so it uses multiple threads. There's typically a dispatcher thread, and there are number of worker threads. Okay, to ensure concurrency, what Apache does is it pre-spawns a number of threads ahead of time. Okay. In your assignment, you would use typically you probably would have used the thread per request architecture, okay, where the thread is created when a new request arrives, okay, and then after the request is serviced, you delete the thread. In Apache, to reduce the overhead of creating and deleting threads, what is done is you pre-spawn a pool of threads. Maybe you pre-spawn 10 or 15 threads, and there's a dispatcher process. Every time request comes in, you look for an idle thread and you send it to that idle thread, and that thread handles that request. Okay, once the request is serviced, the thread goes back to being idle and waits for new request from the dispatcher. Okay. Apache uses what's called dynamic thread management, where the size of this pre-spawn pool is varied dynamically based on the load on the system. Okay, if lots of concurrent requests come to a web server, the size of this pool is increased to prevent queuing. So suppose there are 10 threads you start off with. That allows you to service 10 threads and 10 requests in parallel. Okay? The 11th request comes while these 10 threads are busy and you don't have any more threads, then this request has to wait until one of the thread becomes available. Okay? So to prevent queuing, okay, Apache will dynamically spawn additional threads if it sees queued up requests until a point. Okay, so it has this thread management strategy where it varies the number of threads based on the load on the system. Okay. Now none of that is shown here, that's just an additional bit of information. What is actually shown is the core Apache architecture, which is highly modular. Okay, so it has Apache core where the requests come in and uses a pipelined architecture. This is all the stuff that a single thread does after it has received a request from the dispatcher. Okay, this is the dispatcher. When a request comes in, it's given to a thread. The thread goes and executes all of these functions. Okay, so this is a modular architecture where each functionality, there is a hook and you have a pipeline. Okay, so you can start out by doing HTTP processing, just do protocol processing, extract the request and then send it to the next module, which may then go and retrieve that from a file, then you give it to the next module, which will construct the response. Okay, you give it to the next module, which may send it over a socket, and so it's just showing that it's the modular architecture. Each of these are modules, okay, within Apache. Okay, and you can add more modules. Okay, it's a fairly extensible architecture, so new modules can be easily added. So if you want to add Python processing to HTTP, or you want to add PHP functionality, all of those are just modules that get added. Okay, and then new modules appear in this pipeline that implement that functionality. This is basically a very quick high-level overview of Apache Web Server. That's not the objective of the lecture, but I just wanted to show some of those slides. Okay. This picture basically shows how do you scale a typical website by adding replicas. Okay, so this is basically where some of the parallels between the assignment and the web come in. Okay, so here, if you have a replicated web server, okay, typically this is done for, as I had mentioned, for either performance reason or availability reason. You add more replicas, which, and each of those replicas are on a separate machine. Okay, this allows the website as a whole to service a larger number of concurrent requests, okay, because there are limits to the number of requests that a single machine can handle. Okay, even if the Apache may spawn a lot of threads, eventually you are going to be bound by the processing capacity on the server. If you exceed that, adding more threads does not allow you to do any more, add any more concurrency. The only way to scale then is to add more machines. So typically the way this is done is that you will have a dispatcher. All requests will come to the dispatcher, and the dispatcher will send it to one of the replicas. Okay, and that replica will then handle that that requests, construct a response and send it back. Typically the presence of these replicas will be hidden from the end user. Okay? The end user will actually see this dispatcher as the machine that is masquerading as the web server. Okay? Although the actual web servers are hidden behind the dispatcher itself. The users don't actually see those machines, they see this machine. Okay? This machine interacts with the replicas and constructs responses and send it back. Okay? The one important functionality of the dispatcher, okay, is to load balance all of those replicas. Okay, because you have added replicas, it's important to ensure that all the load that is coming in is more or less equally split across the machines. So there is a load balancing algorithm that is typically implemented in the dispatcher. The most trivial one is round robin. Every incoming request is sent to the next server. So you send the first one to server 1, second one to server 2, and so on. That's a trivial load balancing policy. For most realistic applications, that will not work. And the reason for that is that most of your requests will have session states. So for instance, let's say you go to Amazon. You start browsing and then you add some object to a shopping cart and so on. All of that is state that is kept at the server end. Suppose the first time the user sent a request to the Amazon website, let's say it went to this replica. And then you added some object to your cart. Now that is state that is kept in RAM on this server. If you do trivial round robin, any subsequent request from that user, if it is sent to a different server, that server does not have the state of what this user has done in the past. So you have to keep session specific information in mind when you forward requests. So this load balancer that is in the dispatcher has to be session aware. It needs to ensure that once a new session has started, once a user has come into the system and started browsing, and it has been assigned to a particular server, all requests from that user have to be forwarded to the same server until the session ends. But different sessions can be load balanced across web servers. This is something to keep in mind. So if you don't have session state, then simple load balancing policies like round robin work. If you have session state, then you have to respect that session specific information, which says that once you are assigned to a particular machine, all requests for that session have to go there. Otherwise we have correctness issues. So these load balancing algorithms here tend to be fairly sophisticated. They keep track of sessions, they have to keep track of which users have been assigned where, they have to keep track of the actual load on the servers. You may not necessarily do round robin. You can actually query each of those web servers for the current load and then you do least loaded. Next session goes to the least loaded server, not in a round robin fashion. So things like that are done. So this is basically the same picture as previously shown, but showing a little more detail of the load, where the load balancers are implemented. So here you have this client. This is your switch, the load balancing switch. So what might happen is one way of implementing all of this. The request initially comes in. It is sent to the distributor. This is the load balancing algorithm. So you might have multiple distributors. So you just send it to one of them and say, okay, which machine should I pick for servicing this session? So this distributor may have information about the load on each of these replicas and it might pick saying, okay, go to that server. So then you basically hand off your request or forward the request to that web server and you inform the switch saying this session has been assigned to that web server. So if subsequent requests come in, then this switch keeps state saying all requests of this session actually have to go there. So and then that shows a dispatcher. That typically that dispatcher is a process that is also set here. But in the context of content distribution networks, some of this distribution mechanism is integrated with DNS. I'll talk about that later on in this slide. So this load balancing algorithm may not necessarily be implemented in the switch. It could be implemented elsewhere. For instance, in the you could implement it in the DNS server itself. So when you do a DNS lookup itself, you pick which replica to go to. I'll talk about that later on in this lecture. But for now, just assume that there's a load balancing algorithm. Typically, it's implemented in the front end tiers or in the load balancing switch. But that need not be the case. So the last point of HTTP that I want to mention here is whether the HTTP connections are persistent or not. The first version of the protocol, which was HTTP 1.0, used what is called non-persistent connection, which means that for every HTTP request, you set up a new socket connection between the client and the server. Okay. So the first time you make a request, you set up a socket connection. Okay, you retrieve an HTML file. Suppose that this HTML file has 3 embedded images. Okay. Now you have to retrieve each of these embedded images. Okay. To do that, you will then set up a new socket connect, new TCP connection. Okay. So for each of those, you will have them. So at the end, what you have is there are the multiple socket connections that are open between the client and the server. Okay. One for every HTTP request you send from the browser to the server. Okay. Now what quickly became clear was this is wasteful to do. Okay. The first time you open the connection, that connection is still open. Why not reuse that to send additional HTTP requests? Why keep opening these new connections? Okay. Which increases latency because you have this three-way TCP handshake to even set up the connection. Okay. And it wastes resources at both the client and the server because you have socket-specific state that the OS has to keep track of. Okay. Especially in large servers, this can become a problem. Okay. But there's a limit on the number of open socket connections you can have. Okay. So if you have large servers, you may have 10,000-50,000 socket connections open. That's a lot of state that the kernel has to track. Okay. That can become wasteful. So one way you can actually avoid this overhead is to make TCP connections or HTTP connections persistent. So that's shown in this slide. So in HTTP 1.1, okay, which is the protocol version that's still used today, you have what are called persistent connections. So the first time you send, the browser makes a request to the server, you open a TCP connection. Okay. And then all subsequent requests between the browser and the servers are funneled using the same connection. You don't close that socket once you get your HTML file. You keep it open, which means it's persistent. Okay. And then additional requests are sent over this connection. Okay. So now this will save you the overhead of setting up additional connections and whatnot. The only problem now is you have to figure out when this connection should be closed. If you aggressively close the connection, let's say you have a timeout saying 10 seconds. Okay, if there's no activity for 10 seconds, all the responses have come back, you close it down. Okay. This is good from the server standpoint because you don't have lots of idle connections where there's no activity. Okay, you're cleaning up unneeded sockets quickly and releasing OS resources. Okay. But from a client standpoint, that may not be good because if subsequently the user read a long page and clicked and it took him or her 2 minutes to read this page, and 2 minutes later you have to start off a connection again. Okay. So then you may say, why close it aggressively? Let's not close it for long periods. So let's keep the connection open. Let the timeout value be 30 minutes. Okay, so then you open a connection and you will not close it for a long period of time. Okay. That is good in the sense of if there are subsequent requests from the browser, there is still a connection, you don't have to set one up. But that's wasteful from a server standpoint because there are lots of idle connections here where there is no activity. Okay. And that goes back to the previous problem of having lots of socket connections, which is wasteful in resources. If you have an idle connection, it will still be wasteful. Okay. So in the HTTP 1.1, you have this important problem of figuring out when you have persistent connections, how long to keep them open. Okay, once they have begun idling, once there's no activity. Okay, should it be 1 minute, 5 minutes, 15 minutes? So depending on that, you will have either good reuse or lots of idle connections. Okay, there's a trade-off. And again, there is research on what's the right way to figure this out, depending on the activity on the connection and so on. Okay, so here are some more details of HTTP. Typically, there are several methods in HTTP. Okay, the most common one is what is called a GET method. Okay, GET method is simply allows you to fetch a message from the server. Okay, whenever you send off an HTTP request, your browser constructs an HTTP request of type GET. And then it specifies the name of the files. It could be get index.html. That's the message that's actually sent off to the server. The server gets that file that you named in the get, sends back a response. Okay. The second most common request message type that is used is what's called a post message. Okay. Post message is used to actually send data to the server. Okay. Get retrieves data from the server. Post sends data to the server. And post is typically used when you fill out a web form and you hit submit. Okay, so you have browser, you filled out some form and you hit submit. What your browser does at that point is constructs an HTTP message of the type post, saying here is some data I want to post to the server. Okay, it sends all the fields and all of the data you filled up, constructs a message of type post and sends it off. Okay, and then there are several more. Okay, there's a delete which typically browsers don't implement. Okay, because the web server typically won't allow you to delete a document on the server. There's also put message which allows you to upload a document to the server. Okay, and a delete. So if you have encountered what are called web dev servers, okay, these actually allow you to treat HTTP servers like FTP servers. You can upload and content and you can delete content. So if you have HTTP servers that support web dev functionality, then you actually use put and delete. But typical servers will do these two as the most common ones. Okay, you can also do head just to get the header to figure out when the document changed and so on. Any questions on this? Okay, so here is a very quick flavor of what SOAP looks like. Okay? SOAP is just an HTTP request, okay? But it's basically a special type of request. You are sending or tunneling a RPC request using the HTTP protocol. Okay, so you invoke a RPC request at the server. And the RPC request is constructed as an XML document that you actually send off to the server. This has a lot of details, but the real important lines are these two. Okay. This is like the name of the method you are invoking. These are the arguments to the method. Okay. When any RPC request has two things, it is basically saying I want to invoke this function, and here are the arguments, okay, which you tell. So this is basically the name of the function you are invoking. So you invoke this alert method at the server. Okay. And this is basically the argument. So you are posting this text alert using an alert. Okay. Just as a simple example. So you could have any arbitrary method here and a number of arguments that you specify. That's your RPC request constructed as XML. Send it over HTTP. Server will... the server stub will interpret all of this, call this method with these arguments and send back a response. Yeah, this is how you can construct web services using SOAP. Any questions on this? Okay. So now let's talk about caching. Okay. So this is again going back to our web client proxy server architecture. Okay. So the assumption is there is a single server somewhere. Okay. But to improve performance, the server has employed a number of proxy caches. Okay. These proxy caches store copies of web content that has already been retrieved from the server. These could be web pages, images and whatnot. Okay. There could be a number of, so that's the server there. Okay. And it shows three proxy caches. Okay. And each of them has a disk-based cache. Okay, these caches are disk-based, not memory-based caches, because they can be very large in size. So, typical client would, rather than contacting the server, may first contact the proxy and saying, I want this web page. Okay. The proxy can then look locally to see if the web page is cached. If so, it sends that to the server. If not, it will go to the server, retrieve it, put one copy in the cache and send one copy off to the client. Okay, this is how typically any cache would work. Okay. Now what is important is to ensure that whatever is cached here, okay, is current with respect to what is at the server. If the web page at the server has changed, you shouldn't be serving stale content from the cache. Okay. In other words, even for like in any cache, your web proxy has to implement a cache consistency protocol. Okay. So you have to have some mechanism. Okay, which is not specified in HTTP or anything like this. So it's really up to whoever is writing the proxy to decide what consistency protocol to employ. Okay. But there has to be some mechanism to ensure that whatever you have here is current. Okay. And so question is, how do you go about doing that? Okay. So this is again just showing how the, so this is your browser, this is the web server, request response, now you have a proxy in between. Okay. So the point here is that whenever there is a cache hit, you are never going to talk to the server. Okay, this will reduce the load on the server because the caches will start absorbing some of the requests that would have ordinarily come to the server. Okay. But now you have this additional problem of ensuring that the contents here are up to date. Okay. Now keep in mind that there are some important differences between typical web caches and other types of caching system. Your clients tend to be read-only. Okay. Clients never update the data on the web because something else is updating content on the server. So you can use that. Okay. And the updates only happen at the server in the context of the web. Okay. Which is different from, let's say, a file system. If you have caching in the context of NFS, for instance, this is not the case. Clients will actually modify data. Okay, so the caches have to be more complex there than you need in a web server. Okay, so a big question for us is how should the proxy maintain consistency? Okay, there are two dimensions to this. You can either use a server push or a client pull. Okay, very similar to what you are doing in the assignment, this is the server push architecture. And whenever content has changed, if in the context of server push, you can send an invalidate message or you can send an update. Okay. An invalidate basically says that this file has changed, okay, delete it from your cache because what you have is old. Okay. Update tells you that not only has this file changed, here is the new version of the page, of the web page. Okay, so update is the invalidate plus the new content. Okay, an invalidate just tells you the file has changed. It doesn't tell you what the new version of the file is. Subsequently, you have to go and get it from the server. Okay. So you have to decide whether whenever something changes on the server, should you send out an invalidate or an update, or whether you even use a server push, which is that is the responsibility of the server to ensure caches are consistent, or is it the responsibility of the caches to pull content from the server? The server is not going to do anything. It's going to serve content. The cache consistency protocol is implemented at the proxies. Okay. So let's talk about each approach. So let's start with the push-based approach. This is similar to what is being implemented in your assignment. Okay. So in this case, the server has to track. Okay. This is a stateful approach. Okay. Server needs to know which proxies are storing what content. Okay. So if a proxy has retrieved index.html, you have to keep that information somewhere, saying this proxy retrieved index.html at this time. And so for every proxy out there, you might have to keep some state of what the proxy is and what pages it caches. Okay. If you have thousands of proxies, there will be a lot of state you will keep at the server. Okay. So this can become expensive in terms of the state overhead quickly. Okay. But the advantage here is as soon as a page is modified, because the server knows precisely when the page is modified, it can immediately notify all proxies that have a copy of the page. Okay. In other words, the consistency guarantees you can provide to the caches, okay, are strong. Because as soon as the page is modified, you can send out either an invalidate or you can send out an update. Okay, yes, question there.
The server needs to have the state of what file, what cache is on what file. You just send a notify to everyone and if they don't have the file, just ignore it.
Yeah, so you could send out a notify to everyone, and so that's broadcast based consistency mechanism. That can get very expensive, okay, because if you have, think of the number of servers that are out there. Okay, so let's look at it from a proxy perspective. You have a proxy that's caching some content from multiple websites. Okay, there are millions of web servers out there. Every time somebody changes a page, if you start getting a message saying, oh, this page has changed, you may not even care about this page. So proxies will have lots of wasteful messages that they don't care about. Okay? And now think of it from a server perspective. There may be millions of proxies out there. Okay, this is the web, right? I mean, there's no limit on the number of proxies or the number of servers. So the server might actually have to broadcast to, every time a page changes, you have to send 1 million messages, HTTP messages saying this page has changed. That may also be wasteful because not all of these proxies may care about your content. So you have to be smarter. You can't really use, when you are talking about web scales, broadcast based mechanisms are not going to work. Yeah, because there will be a lot of wasteful messages. So you have to be smarter in terms of how you do it. Okay. So typically that means you have to keep track of who is caching what. Okay, and then you deliver targeted messages saying if this page has changed, you only send it to those proxies that cache this page. This message. Yes. So the state maintenance is a problem, which is why we'll talk about content distribution as a way to solve this state problem. Okay, so we'll come to that in just a moment. But for now, it should be clear that this is going to be have a high state main overhead, okay, because there may be lots of proxies. Okay. But for now, we'll assume we can pay this price. Okay, we'll keep all of the state. But whenever a page is changed, okay, you can send a notification immediately. So important thing about the server push protocol is that the consistency guarantees can be strong. Okay. You can ensure that there will never be stale content, because as soon as it changes, you send out a message. Okay. You can send two types of message. An invalidate message, which just tells the cache saying index.html changed. Okay, very similar to what you have done here. Okay, so all that the cache has to do at that point is take the cached file and just delete it, saying this is an old file, so I no longer store it. Okay. Subsequently, if a request for that file comes to that cache, it can go back to the server and retrieve that page. Okay. Or you can send the new version of the object. So not only do you tell the proxy the file has changed, you actually send here is index new version of index.html. Okay. So the advantage of doing this is you are actually giving the new content to the proxy immediately. So any subsequent request doesn't require the proxy to retrieve that content from the server. It can be immediately serviced. Okay. The disadvantage is you may be sending this file to proxies that no longer want it. Okay. Suppose proxy A got a index.html 3 days back. Okay. There's no client that this proxy is serving that wants this content anymore, but it is still in the cache. Okay. So the server may be sending new versions of this file for no reason. If there are no users are accessing this file, then why should the server keep sending it? Okay. So you should only send updates when it is clear that this is a popular web page. That it is very likely that by sending this proactively to the cacher, that is likely to get accessed by the end users. Okay. If a web page is not popular, it's better off sending invalidate, because you don't know whether anyone else is going to access it. So you just tell the cache saying file has changed. If some user asks for it, come back and ask me for it later. Okay. So there's this, again, this decision of how to decide whether to send invalidate or update. So for popular files, it's okay to go with updates, but not popular files, you're better off doing invalidates, okay, which is what is shown here. Send updates for more frequently accessed objects, invalidate for the rest. Any questions on this? Okay. So, quick advantages, disadvantages. First advantage, tight consistency, minimizes stale data. Proxies can be passive. Proxies don't have to do work here. Okay, servers are doing most of the work of cache consistency. Okay. Disadvantage is that server becomes stateful. HTTP by itself is stateless. Okay. Now the server has to keep track of all this proxy state, as we talked about. It can be a lot of data. Okay. The bigger problem is you don't know for how long to keep this state. Okay. Suppose some proxy goes and accesses a web page from a server. Okay. One time request. Subsequently, let's say this proxy does not get any user requests from end users for this web page. Okay. Question is, for how long should the server keep track of this proxy, saying it actually accesses? Should it be 1 month, 1 day, 10 days? Okay. By default, a server push method says state has to be maintained indefinitely. There's no way for you to know in this protocol that the proxy is no longer interested in this web page. Stop sending invalidates or updates. Okay. So state has to be maintained indefinitely, which means there's a high overhead here. We'll see ways to address this, okay, in just a couple of slides. Okay, and then anytime you have stateful servers, your crashes, then your problem. Okay, if you keep the state in memory, this state is going to go away. So you might have to keep it on disk, which means there's more IO requests, okay, whenever you update the state. Okay. Here's a client pull based, or rather proxy based approach. Okay, the pull based approach. Here the responsibility of cache consistency is completely on the proxy. Server is not going to provide any intelligence in terms of cache consistency. Okay. So the way this is implemented typically is using polling. Okay. The proxy can poll the web server to ask specifically if the content has changed. Okay. So typically the way this is done is there's a type of an HTTP message, which I didn't show you when I was put up this get put kind of things, which is called an IMS message, if modified since message. Okay. So what this does is you can send a get, it's called a conditional get message. Okay, you say I want this page but send it to me if it has changed since this time. So it says if modified since, and then you specify a timestamp. Okay. So what this tells the server, what the server does now is it actually takes the timestamp that has come with the GET message and looks at the last modified time for this web page. Okay. If the web page has not been modified since this time, the server just sends back a message saying you are the most recent version. Okay. Otherwise, it sends it a new version. So this is basically a conditional GET. It says send me the page, but only send it to me if it has changed since this time. Okay. So what can the proxy do with this? Okay, suppose a request for a web page comes in. Let's assume it's actually cached. Okay. But the proxy does not know whether this cached content is current or if it's stale. Okay. So what the proxy can do is send an IMS message to the server saying I retrieved this from you at, let's say, noon yesterday. Okay. So I'm going to do a GET on this web page, but send it to me only if it has changed since yesterday noon. Otherwise, don't send it to me because I already have the most recent version. So you will only retrieve selectively using this request. Okay. That's one way by which you can ensure that whatever you are sending back to the server or rather the end user is current. Now, one question is how frequently should you do this polling? Okay. So, should you do this every time a user request comes for a web page? If so, then you have defeated the whole purpose of caching. Every time a user request came in, if you have to send an IMS request to the server, okay, then you will actually add additional round trip latency to the time you are responding to the end user. Okay. But the whole point of caching is you cache content close to users so that you don't have to go to the server. So you don't have to interact with the server. So you could say, I only poll periodically, I don't poll on every request. But this can make your consistency guarantees weaker. If you don't poll on every request, the web page actually changed since the last time you polled, then you are stale content, you are serving stale content to the server. Okay. So the point, big difference between poll based or pull based approaches and push based approaches is pull based approaches will necessarily provide weaker consistency guarantees. Only way to provide strong guarantees is to send a conditional GET or an IMS request on every client request. Every time a user request comes, you first check with the server, do you have the most recent page or not? Okay. But typically you will not do that because that's too expensive. Okay. If you are going to go to the server on every request, what's the point of the cache? I mean, the server has to process every request anyway. Okay. So typically what is done is there are many approaches to deal with this problem. So the server can assign what is called a time to live value for a page. Okay, it's called a TTL. This is also called an expiration time for a page. Every time you request a page, you send a TTL value saying this page is valid for the next 1 hour. Okay. This is basically a guess on the part of the server on how much time can you cache this page with some reasonable confidence that it is not going to change. The server knows that the page changes every 2 days. You can send a page saying, okay, keep it for 6 hours, check back after 6 hours. With high confidence, I believe it will not change in the next 6 hours. So this proxy can then keep an expiration value. Okay? So long as this TTL has not expired, you don't check with the server. You don't send IMS request. You just get a cache hit and you send back a response. But if that TTL value has expired, then you go back to the server saying with this message saying has the page changed. Okay. So you do conditional gets only upon expirations of TTL values. Yeah, this is how proxies will typically work. Yes, question. Does it mean after the expiration page is discarded? It does not mean the page has to be discarded. All it means is at this point you should really check with the server before serving content. Okay, the page may have changed.
So what happens if the cache is full and you want to replace it? So if you send a conditional, does it mean that one of the pages that is already there in the cache will be replaced?
Yes. So what you are asking about is cache replacement. Cache replacement is orthogonal to cache consistency. Cache replacement just says I can store a fixed number of objects n. Okay, n may be 10,000, 1 million, doesn't matter. But it's a fixed number. Okay. So as new content comes in, some content has to be discarded. Okay, so that has nothing to do with cache consistency. You can just take the oldest object and throw it away, for instance. Okay. all that cache consistency is doing is for the objects that are present in the cache. How do I ensure that the data is current, hasn't changed at the server? Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Now the thing to keep in mind is that time to live value is only a guess on the part of the server on when this document is likely to change. The server cannot enforce it. The server cannot force a user to stop updating a web page, their web page, because it specifies some TTL to a cache. Okay? So even though you may have a page that has not expired in the proxy, it can change at the server. Okay? There's no guarantee, just a guess. In most cases, it may be a good guess, but it's not a guarantee. Guess is not the same as a guarantee. Okay? So the thing to keep in mind is, even though you may have a server assigned TTL value, it will not guarantee that the page has not changed. The only way to check, guarantee that the contents are fresh, is to really check with the server. That's the only real way to ensure consistency. Yes.
What about dynamic pages that change every load?
Yes. Okay, so that's a good point. What about dynamic pages that change on every load? So pages that are typically generated dynamically, okay, will have a no cache flag set on it, which prevents the proxies from caching it at all. Because the page is generated on the fly on every request, only the server can generate it, because the server has to code to generate it. So you will not cache those content at all.
You could cache the code and the proxy could run like the PHP script.
You could certainly run the code and have the proxy run it, but you may have to have access to the database if the PHP makes. So typically what is done is proxies will still, even if you have dynamically generated pages, if you have embedded GIF images or large JPEG images, okay, those can get cached, okay, because the real burden comes from serving large files. Okay, so you can generate the PHP page on the fly, but the links that are embedded in it may be at the server. Okay. But typically dynamically generated content not cached. Okay. This is one problem with proxy caching, because in the old days most of the content was static. It was static HTML. Okay. These days pretty much any sophisticated server generates content on the fly. So it's not possible to use static HTML pages. So you can't really use caching for that mechanism. Which is why this was a very popular mechanism 8-10 years ago. These days it's not that popular. It's only popular for caching static content like HTML, not HTML, GIF images or large distribution, large downloads. If you have a software that you're selling, you can cache that, push that into the caches, serve it from the cache, because those things don't change well, frequently.
How about like self-service for
any
like CNN.com?
Yes. Yeah. So CNN. That's basically what I was going to say here. So there will be content that may be static, but it may change very frequently. Right. If you take typical CNN is a good example. CNN web page, if you look at it, changes every 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, because it will have a news feed from Associated Press or Reuters. Every minute or two, there will be a news item that appears. Same with any other news site. So then the question is, even if it may not be dynamically generated, but it changes very frequently, what do you do? Okay, how do you cache it? Should you cache it at all, first of all? If you don't cache it, then the server has to be prepared to service a large number of users. That means you have to have a server replication. Okay? If you do cache it, then you have to ensure that the consistency protocol that the caches use are strong enough to ensure that, I mean, if it's going to change every minute, then you'd better make sure that whatever you're using will actually either send an invalid date or cause the cache to retrieve the content every minute or two to ensure it's fresh. Okay, otherwise, it's a problem. Okay. It may change every minute, but if your server is CNN, you probably are serving hundreds of thousands of requests in that 1 minute. So even caching this one page for 1 minute allows you to ensure that the proxy services is 100,000 requests, not the server. Okay. So one approach that is typically used is to dynamically poll or dynamically do this conditional retrieve based on the frequency of updates, not the popularity. Okay. For pages that change more frequently, poll more frequently. For pages that change less frequently, poll less frequently. Okay. So we use mechanisms like this. This automatically ensures that more frequently accessed pages are more aggressively fetched from the server. Okay. And less frequently accessed pages, you check less frequently. So this ensures that whatever you are storing in your cache is more or less up to date. Doesn't give you absolute guarantee, but it is actually going to adapt whatever caching mechanism to the rate of updates to the page. Okay, so for CNN page, you may go back to the server every minute, every 30 seconds. For some my page, you may go every month, because I don't change it.
But right? Most of the content on CNN or any other static, the thing that normally changes every minute are RSS feeds.
Yes.
RSS feeds are not the ones that are.
Most of the content is not necessarily static. The layout will change and things like that. So, what's your question exactly?
I mean, when you're talking about caching or whatever, with respect to whatever changes every minute or so.
Yeah.
Those news stickers and all are normally RSS feeds that tend to keep getting updated every day.
Right. So, I mean, typical web pages are complex things, right? So, there will be lots of different components. There will be, let's say, the banner. CNN, that's never going to change, not never, but it will not change frequently. Maybe once every few months they may update the logo. There will be, I mean, you can look at a typical page. You go to a web page. So there will be things like the ticker, which are dynamically generated fragments within a static page. Okay? Those you will never cache. Okay? Those will just have the link that requires you to go back to the server. But there will be other things like images that you will cache. Okay, let's go to, just take an example. So if you look at this web page, okay, so there are ads. Of course, ads may not be cached at the proxy, they may be cached at the ad server. So here is this sidebar. This is not going to change frequently. Okay? Here is, let's say, stock ticker. Right? So this also you will not cache. So what that means is the embedded thing here, that is just HTML code, will not be cached. Okay, this part will actually require the web browser to go to something to fetch this content and display it. But this may the proxy may itself send. Okay, this image you can actually cache at the server. Okay, so here are so here is something that is basically changing frequently. These are the most recent blog posts or recent news. So those you may not necessarily cache, or if you cache, then you will basically set a very short TTL or cause the proxies to poll more frequently. So how to typically cache pages that are as complex as this is not a trivial problem. It's not just one HTML page. This page actually has various what are called fragments. Some fragments are dynamically generated. Some fragments are static. So if you actually have login, for instance, so it has my name. So that part is dynamically generated there. It has my name in there. So you can't cache that because different users will have different user IDs. But this part will not be different for anyone. It will be the same. So you can actually cache this fragment. So there are proxies that are sophisticated enough to interact with the server and figure out what parts of the page. It's not just cache the whole page or nothing, but you can cache parts of the page. So that's how typically you can do. Yes?
PHP, it actually has like a web page, and inside it little tags are PHP specific that change things dynamically. So you just say those are the snippets that I want to don't want to cache, and everything else in cache.
Yeah, so if you have complete, so the New York Times page is not necessarily generated dynamically. Only certain fragments may be generated dynamically. But if you have a PHP page, the whole page is actually generated dynamically. In this case, the conservative thing to do is not cache anything. But if you have static content within the page, you can actually tell the proxy saying you can cache this part of it. Okay? So the whole page may be sent back, but the part of it which is embedded, for instance, the proxy, the browser can go to the proxy and cache. Okay, for instance. So this is basically a sophisticated set of techniques that people have come up with. Okay, so I'm just presenting some very simple ideas, but it can get very complicated depending on how complex your page is, what some parts may be static, some parts may not be, and so on. Okay, yes, last
question. So let's say I'm searching for news that was 20 days older. So in that case, let's say cache is discarded. So in that case, will the proxy server go back to the server?
Yes. So if you are looking for a web page that is not in the cache, it's called a cache miss. Okay. Whether it's something that has never been retrieved or something that was retrieved and then discarded by the cache. In both cases, it's a cache miss. Cache miss causes the proxy to go back to the server to retrieve it. Okay. So that's very simple. It doesn't matter what caused the miss. You just go to the server. Okay. So we'll stop here. We'll continue this next time. And the one more announcement is I'm going to put up a homework. because the last homework today, so keep an eye on it. I'll send out an email as soon as I put it up.
Are we going to get the midterms back soon?
Yes, I have started the grading, but it's not done. Thursday, hopefully.